Wasteland, A World in Permanent Crisis. Author, Robert D. Kaplan. Chapter 3, Crowds and Chaos. The fundamental change in geopolitics has not been fully realized. Great power divides, the collapse of empires, the shrinkage of geography through technology, the legacy of communism, and Shakespearean decline all play monumental roles in the roiling instability of our world. But there is something at once broader and more subtle that affects both world politics and our daily lives. In fact, the primary change in geopolitics is urbanization, and the intensification of politics that it leads to. Over 55% of humanity lives in cities, by 2050 over two-thirds of humanity will be urban, and increasingly densely urban. In 1975 there were only three megacities with populations in the tens of millions, Tokyo, New York, and Mexico City. By 2014 there were 34 such cities. This is a primary change because while great power fractures affect foreign affairs on a surface level, urbanization combined with social media provides the psychological and cultural undercurrents that drive foreign affairs from below the surface, making international politics more turbulent. So I need to describe it? Perhaps nobody in the 20th century understood cities on a human level, what made them work, what made them not work, and what they originally were supposed to be, like the late American-Canadian journalist Jane Jacobs, author of the masterpiece The Death and Life of Great American Cities. Jacobs cut through all the theory and jargon to announce that it was all about sidewalks, not scale, not how tall or beautiful the buildings were. If a city's streets look interesting, the city looks interesting, if they look dull, the city looks dull. Unlike towns and outlying suburbs, cities are, by definition, full of strangers. And it is the effect of one stranger upon another, and one store upon another and upon each pedestrian, that, Jacobs explains, determines the success or failure of a city. Lowly, unpurposeful, and random as they may appear, sidewalk contacts are the small change from which a city's wealth of public life may grow. Neighborhoods, and by extension sidewalks, require people of different income groups to function and interact with each other, she implied. Of course, nowadays too many cities and downtowns, at least during the daytime, are for the wealthy, and for people who are all alike rather than different, resulting in what Jacobs prophetically calls the great blight of dullness. Indeed, everyone in wealthy districts thinks of themselves as just so fascinating, and dresses accordingly, that in straining to be unique they are all actually the same. Jacobs says that it is differences, not duplications, that make for well-functioning and truly aesthetic cities. But too often the result is monotony, in which one city, and one part of town along with its inhabitants, almost exactly resembles another. And because, over the years and decades, as wealth has poured into American cities, resulting in new and glitzier buildings, only the chain stores and restaurants can afford the rents, adding another layer of dullness. This has especially been the case with American cities, which came into being as places where people could make money, unlike European and Asian ones, which were founded as centers of culture and political power, explain the urbanists Dennis R. Judd and Todd Swanstrom. 3. Cities, not just in America but all over the world, glittering and monochrome, with traffic jams everywhere, have grown in such scale, anchoring our very tightening global system, that Jacobs's comments about sidewalks and neighborhoods may seem quaint, however necessary they still are. In fact, Jacobs's observations easily apply to cities all over the world, which can be dull or interesting depending upon the factors she describes. Indeed, cities were never tidy and picturesque, as Jacobs well knew. They were always difficult places. In almost the same year that Jacobs published her monumental and hopeful book, the poet Robert Lowell detected a savage servility beginning to overtake formerly genteel Boston. Decades earlier, in fact, the critic Edmund Wilson was struck by people grinding at barren office routine in the cells of gigantic cities. And in the mid-19th century, the Scottish essayist Thomas Carlyle saw in the crowds of London a vision of maggots teeming in cheese. That was the London that served as a spiritual backdrop for much of Charles Dickens's famously harsh fiction about the human condition. Jacobs was not oblivious to any of this. The city for her was a project, a place that could be made to work. She saw in successful cities places where opinions might be different but people could still get along, as a result of civic pride and politeness. That was the whole point. What she did not see, because she wrote in the middle and latter part of the 20th century, before there was the merging of digital platforms with city life, and henceforth the monumental effect of social media on city life, was how cities, rather than places, of glorious varieties of opinion, could also become loci of categorical crowd behavior and psychology. From Carlyle in the mid-19th century to Jacobs in the mid and late 20th, we have visions of the city during the whole span of the Industrial Revolution. The city of the digital revolution is and could be something quite different, as the city has been changing before our eyes. In fact, Jacobs's world has been superseded. The American-Canadian architect Witold Rybczynski writes that the most successful urban neighborhoods have attracted not the blue-collar families that she celebrated, but the rich and the young. 70 urbanist Joel Kotkin observes that in this new consumer city, the role that the priests and aristocrats played in imperial cities has been assumed by the global wealthy, financial engineers, media moguls, and other top business executives and service providers. The most talented, ambitious, and wealthiest people are converging as never before in a relative handful of leading superstar cities and knowledge and tech hubs, writes another prominent urbanist, Richard Florida. He calls this the clustering force of talent and economic activity that is sorting out and resegregating society by income, education, and class. 9 But the segregated classes can also be in shoulder-to-shoulder proximity with each other. Even in nouveau hipster and increasingly expensive Brooklyn, notes Kotkin, nearly a quarter of residents, mainly African-American and Latino, are below the poverty line. While the wealthy gentry shop at artisanal cheese shops and frequent trendy restaurants, one in four Brooklynites receive food stamps. Within these well-heeled and hip enclaves, Kotkin goes on, you see the same structures, be it from Frank Gehry or some other starchitect. Increasingly, city skylines and waterfront developments appear remarkably similar, becoming what Dutch architect Ram Koolhaas labeled the generic city. Jane Jacobs's vision of lively yet unpretentious sidewalks where people of different classes and opinions mix in a variety of architectural settings has been turned on its head. Within each income and professional group now there is a growing and frightening conformity, dramatized by alienating architectural sameness. Places like Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Boston are actually much better off, as their venerable past and proximity to water has engendered original aesthetics and intimate cluttering compared to many other world cities like Atlanta, Sao Paulo, Houston, and Los Angeles, where Jacobs's great blight of dullness has for quite some time now been a stark reality. These differences and pathologies are crucial, since it is through their immediate surroundings that the masses, increasingly urban, experience and react to world events and geopolitics. The world just looks different, depending upon where you sit. Nobody has described the great blight of dullness better and more passionately than the late conservative English philosopher Roger Scruton. He describes the modern vernacular composed of curtain walls or horizontal slabs, without moldings, shadows, or ornaments standing as a familiar adversary in our streets. The shoebox style, he calls it, that you can find on the edge, and increasingly in the center of our towns. The apologists for this kind of everyday modernism, who reject the Greek and Gothic revivals, and all of the classical orders, in fact, also reject the street as the primary public space. The result is what Scruton refers to as the concrete wastes of a modern Western city and the vandalization of the landscape and townscape. He implies that the postmodern city, rather than evince Jacobs's humanity, stands, at least in its architecture, as a rejection of the individual and the whole past with its traditions, in fact. And if people, on account of their surroundings, are less anchored to a past, empires, monarchies, and all the other traditions that have historically maintained states and societies are even more likely to dissolve, and to do so more quickly. Cities, therefore, in their current context, can be the conservatives' worst nightmare, because classical conservatives are more interested in conserving tradition than in erecting new and uncertain ones. And yet cities are simply where it's at. They are where politics and foreign policy get made. So it's time to investigate another, deeper layer of the urban reality that particularly concerns us, and which flows out from the somewhat dystopian visions and fears of Scruton, Kotkin, Florida, and other philosophers and urbanists. The fact is, people, ideas, and movements are less stable in cities than in the countryside. That is because cities are where the chemistry of intellectual exchange usually happens, in surroundings if not architecturally alienating, then at least disorienting in terms of crowds and noisy factories and other types of mayhem. Marx, Lenin, Hitler, and so forth all incubated their ideas in European cities. So did Kant, Sartre, and a multitude of other philosophers. Even Mao, the son of a peasant, adopted Marxism-Leninism while at Peking University. Cities just wouldn't be cities if they weren't the places where ideas, whether good or bad, are frequently born. In fact, cities, which separate humanity from the natural world and its rhythms, as Roger Scruton's critique of their architecture demonstrates, are friendly to ideologies and to the abstractions that form them. It follows, both directly and indirectly, that chaos and crowd behavior are primarily features of cities, as those things emerge from ideas, too. History is obviously made in the countryside, a lot of it. It was the very calmness of rural Vermont that helped enable Solzhenitsyn to gather his thoughts about the 20th century's greatest revolution. But far more history is made in cities. Postmodern democracies are rooted in the cosmopolitanism of city life, even as politicians constantly appeal to the rural interior. This actually is an extraordinary development. In the early and middle eras of the American Republic, democracy, it could be argued, was determined by the countryside and particularly by the heartland, where a number of candidates for high office in the late 19th century, James Garfield, Benjamin Harrison, William McKinley, had all conducted successful front porch presidential campaigns, rarely straying far from their home districts in the Midwest, and yet ending up in the White House. Of course, elections can still be determined by voting blocks in the same heartland. But the themes and ideas of presidential campaigns now are increasingly filtered, and given their slants, through elite media establishments and cosmopolitan cities, generally on the East Coast, so that presidential elections are national in character in a powerful way that they never used to be. A candidate is now packaged, as though a product in an advertisement. The New York Times, which in addition to its digital website has satellite printing plants throughout the country, has a deep effect on every national and many statewide elections across the continent that would have astounded earlier generations of American politicians, even as Times reporters collectively represent the outlook that is, the viewpoints and even the prejudices of urban cosmopolitans in the global world. That's right, prejudices, too. Cosmopolitan city life can at times be intolerant and conditioned by the mood of the multitude. A lie or half-truth can ricochet endlessly within the crowd before the full truth emerges, often too late to repair reputations and affect an outcome. This is how rumors that feed anger and, in some cases, a virulent sectarian nationalism can migrate across the developing world. For here I am not just talking about the wealthy West and its cosmopolitan cities. Because of digital connectivity, cities anywhere, with their packed humanity, can be dangerous places, especially prone to information manipulation. Occasional lies, rumors, and half-truths can mar small-town life, to be sure. But the effect, the craziness, is greater in cities. Social media and the digital video age only amplify crowd psychology. The whole web is a city. The Trump phenomenon, which took off in vast areas of the country, urban, suburban, and rural, with its followers willing to believe just about anything, is much harder to imagine in an earlier age of technology. But New York Times conservative columnist Ross Douthat goes much further in describing the social media and digital world of the young, with its pinball motion between extremes of toxic narcissism and the solidarity of the mob, its therapy speak unmoored from real community, its conspiracism and ideological crazes. This, in fact, is not necessarily an urban world, since it could afflict small-town teenagers, too. But it is more likely to be an urban or a suburban phenomenon, since here we have social media replicating the frantic conditions of the city with its numberless interactions. The mass society is upon us in a way we never imagined. The root cause of crowd psychology is in the very spatial pattern of human contact on city streets and inside apartment blocks. Urbanity changes us. It rewires us, and as we will see, not always for the better. The new world geography is more fearsome than the old, and more destabilizing in terms of excitable public opinion. Thus will geopolitics deteriorate. This phenomenon will never be announced in the headlines. Indeed, it cannot be announced in the headlines since it is an organic process rather than an event. But you will observe it in the very heated, hysterical debates over politics, domestic and foreign, that now never cease. The mass society was originally a creature of the late 18th and 19th centuries, as the British historian and journalist Dominic Green informs us. The English, American, and French revolutions had not been aberrations, they had been harbingers of mass democracy and nationalism. The vocabulary of modern politics had arrived: constitutions, parliaments, national rights, and even natural ones. Mass politics, with its parties, rallies, platforms, and voting, would become part of everyone's life. The personal would be political, and the name of the modern catechism was ideology. 3. Ideology, with its many frightening isms, appeared to reach its climax in the 20th century. Alexander Watt, a great Polish poet and intellectual whose life was coterminous with the 20th century and who had family members literally destroyed by both Nazism and Communism, wrote, in regard to Stalinism, that it was the global answer to negation. That hunger for something all-embracing. There was too much of everything. Too many people, too many ideas, too many books. This is the abundance of the city that Watt is describing. The only way to cope was with a simple catechism, an idea that would crush all the others. Stalinism's answer was to turn the inner life to dust. Because Stalinism killed the inner man, it represented the exteriorization of everything. 14. If there were too many books and ideas and people back in Watt's day, that would be only a fraction of what one must cope with now. The soul itself, explains the contemporary Romanian philosopher Horia Roman Potapivisai, is being hollowed out because of its being bombarded by stimuli and the substitution of the inner imagination by technology, smartphones, intelligent toys, the array of electronics at malls, and artificial intelligence itself. Again, it is the city and overabundant suburbia that is the principal stage set for all of this. And within it people may be ready for a new catechism, or a succession of them. It is the masses speaking through one voice that are the danger. Most people think that they generate their own ideas, in fact, their ideas are prepared by others who think for them. The idea that some sermon or blog post or tweet has gone viral is a sad resection on the state of individualism. Cities, as we know, have become venues for elites. And elites have an undeniable proclivity for groupthink and echo chambers, despite all their erudition. Different elite factions pick their own facts and construct opinions. The elites, even more so than the rest of us, are slaves of their smartphones. And they are always Googling. And Google ranks search results in terms of how many other sites have linked to them, reinforcing such groupthink, not individuality. We speak of buzzwords and fashionable new acronyms and media feeding frenzies. These are all symptoms of urban elite groupthink. And, of course, different groupthinks collide with each other through competing silos and echo chambers. There is just a madness about the great, pulsing cities, perhaps most negatively encapsulated by supercrowded, overcapitalized, and touristed Times Square, with crowds swerving around both the homeless and the police, whose weapons and uniforms increasingly evoke Army Special Forces units. This brings us abruptly to Oswald Spengler, the great German philosopher, historian and polymath of the early 20th century, perhaps the greatest of all time, and the author of the massive two-volume tome The Decline of the West, Der Untergang der Abendlands, published in 1918 and 1922. Spengler's vast knowledge base was a rebuke to specialization and offered an unparalleled celebration of general education. The German Academy, with its emphasis on narrow credentials, despised this former schoolmaster who lived in cloistered poverty prior to his fame, and then again in isolation at the end of his life under Hitler. Although, as the decades pass, the clairvoyance of his work borders on startling, despite his difficult-to-follow discursions into the cultural nature of mathematics, the Faustian and Magian soul, the Gothic will, and so forth. The despised Spengler, he was denounced and misunderstood by nearly everyone from liberals to conservatives to the Nazis of his own time, had, in fact, studied Greek, Latin, mathematics, and the sciences, even as he had a great propensity for the arts. He has much to tell us about our time, however ultra-conservative his judgments. He saw cultural decline in everything from violent labor unrest, to sports spectacles reminiscent of the Roman Colosseum, to the emergence of the liberated Ibsen woman, to the whole megalopolitan literature, in fact, and to the emphasis on entertainment in just about everything. I will begin with the Spengelman nugget, whereas the countryside produces the folk, the world city, that is, in our context, the internet, produces the mob. Obviously, the folk, with its connection to a mythically pure and specific homeland, and thus its innate hatred of cosmopolitanism, can be dangerous, too. Yale historian Timothy Snyder, in an early book, The Reconstruction of Nations, 2003, connects folkishness to mass murder, as the supposed purity of a particular peasant group declares in effect the inferiority of rival and proximate groups, which in wartime conditions can then be eliminated. Both fascism and communism have romanticized the folk and their assumed innocence and virtue. Over the decades as a foreign correspondent, I can remember watching state-controlled television in a number of totalitarian states where the only entertainment on offer was the dictator's harangues interspersed with peasant dances. In such a way, the ruling chieftain governed in a folkloric paradise. In the United States, with its much higher standard of economic development and its liberal democracy, this same phenomenon is, nevertheless, apparent, obliquely, of course. In America, the folk can be gun-toting, Second Amendment followers of Donald Trump and Tucker Carlson, nostalgic for an older and less complicated America, perhaps even for the Confederacy, and beset with conspiracy theories about electoral fraud, as they challenge the liberal bastions of the world media and cosmopolitan city. But the folk in the countryside are in demographic decline, one reason, perhaps, for their extremism in the first place, as their less complicated and more rural world of traditional values is literally eaten away by newish suburbs and exurbs and intrusive technology, as urbanization takes its toll. And as urbanization and ever more crowded suburbanization become increasingly inexorable, the future belongs to the mob. While the folk on the political right are obsessed with conspiracy theories, the mob on the political left is obsessed with conformity: if you don't agree with us on every point, we will destroy you. The urban riots and looting that caused significant property damage and created pockets of anarchy in downtowns across the United States, leading to at least 200 cities announcing curfews following the Minneapolis police murder of African American George Floyd in May 2020, were only the most extreme example of the mob in action. Gary Saul Morson, a professor of Russian literature at Northwestern University, said that those riots bore a similarity with those that preceded the Bolshevik Revolution, since in both cases you had the phenomenon of well-intentioned liberal people, a true intelligentsia, who couldn't bring themselves to say that lawlessness is wrong. He goes on, when you're dragged along into something you don't really believe yourself, because otherwise you are identified with those evil people, and your primary identity is being a good guy, you will wind up supporting things that are abhorrent. And unless there is some moral force that will stop it, the slide will accelerate. In fact, Both America in 2020 and Russia in 1917 demonstrated the phenomenon of genuinely liberal people socially intimidated into supporting movements to their far left, which also happened to be violent. But the urban mob of today is rarely a physical mob, it is for our purposes a large gathering of voices all in complete agreement and bent on the destruction of a single individual, in order to intimidate the many. This kind of mob is the ultimate enemy of freedom, since its effect is to abolish individual thought itself. Remember that Nazism and Stalinism worked most often in silencing individual thought, so that everyone agreed with each other. So-called cancel culture, in which a person's professional standing and ability to speak and publish are either reduced or, in rare cases, extinguished as, obviously, is their ability to make a living all on the basis of an opinion or opinions he or she may hold, is an example of such a virtual mob. This is Stalinism without any of the violence and imprisonment. Or Leninism, for that matter, since Lenin was the one who essentially invented the notion of totality, that the total result of a life is determined by one's acceptance of a single idea. If you don't believe in communism and the rule of the party, it does not matter how good you are at your job, be it as a technician, a submariner, an engineer, or whatever, since you are nothing and must therefore be erased. I may be taking the concept of cancel culture much too far, but the similarities are eerie and chilling. Yet to truly imagine a more subtle and futuristic urban mob, consider the large group of New York Times staffers, many of them located in their apartments throughout the New York metropolitan area, in the midst of the coronavirus effective lockdown, somewhat lonely one might assume, in unison, they vented their cabin fever frustrations on Twitter and other social media to get opinion editor James Bennett and op-ed editor James Deo removed from their jobs for running an essay by Republican Senator Tom Cotton that argued in favor of using federal troops to curb the urban riots ignited by the George Floyd killing. There are two key elements in this event. One was the combination of the coronavirus restrictions and the riots. Were the COVID-19 restrictions not in place, Times staffers might have met more often in person and argued more often among themselves over coffee, and the dynamic of what transpired might have been different. It was the mid-20th century philosopher Hannah Arendt, in The Origins of Totalitarianism, who suggested that repressive political systems rely on the loneliness of individuals who need to escape their condition and be part of a mass. The second element in the affair was technology, which had created untold vistas for the tyranny of the 21st century crowd, it seemed. A self-righteous mob, organized from the bottom up, had virtually defenestrated two long-standing and undeniably liberal editors at America's most influential newspaper for being insufficiently virtuous, for not being pure and therefore ideological in their opinions. As I write, the liberal mainstream media is now, 2.5 years later, having second thoughts and consequently coming to Bennett's defense in a few brave instances. Referring to an earlier article in Semaphore, Eric Wemple, the Washington Post media critic, defends Bennett for saying about New York Times publisher A.G. Sulzberger, "He set me on fire and threw me in the garbage and used my reverence for the institution against me. This is why I was so bewildered for so long after I had what felt like all my colleagues treating me like an incompetent fascist." In fact, as Wemple documents, Sulzberger, who initially supported Bennett for running a legitimate opinion by Senator Cotton, a potential presidential candidate at the time, quickly folded upon the onslaught from the mob at the New York Times, members of which tweeted that the very publication of Cotton's essay puts black staff in danger, without explaining how that was possible. Sulzberger and other Times officials ran the Cotton essay through a rigorous second fact-checking process, even though the piece had already been rigorously fact-checked, in the hope of discrediting it. And this was all because of a social media mob of generally younger staff. As it happened, the second fact-checking substantiated the first. Wemple called attention to the hollowness of the entire internal uproar at the Times, even as he confessed for reasons of cowardice and mid-career risk management his own 2.5-year delay in writing this. 19 Jonathan Chait, a pundit and writer for New York Magazine, believes that Wemple is not alone in his view of how he and others spinelessly accepted Bennett's and Deo's defenestration in the moment that it happened. It is an unhealthy culture that forces people to suppress their doubts and mouth platitudes for fear of losing their livelihoods, Chait writes, adding that what Wemple's confession reveals is that these purges have a multiplier effect. For every person humiliated or fired for a small or non-existent offense, many other people will refuse to criticize even transparently absurd left-wing pieties. 20. Another example of such a piety was the unwillingness to tolerate even the idea that the coronavirus might have originated in a laboratory in China. This effectively silenced the media on the subject until such a possibility was revealed as indeed plausible. There are few things more destabilizing for geopolitics than for the media in each competing country to give the masses a distorted version of reality on account of groupthink and the fear of facing an unpleasant truth. This is how governments can be influenced by the mob, and, on occasion, drift into unnecessary wars. Spengler, in The Decline of the West, saw all of this coming, after a fashion. For it was journalists and their profession that may have terrified him the most. As for the modern press, Spengler writes, the sentimentalist may beam with contentment when it is constitutionally free, but the realist merely asks at whose disposal it is. No tamer has his animals more under his power than the press, he goes on. Unleash the people as reader mass and it will storm through the streets and hurl itself upon the target indicated. The press today is an army with journalists as officers, and readers as soldiers. A more appalling caricature of freedom of thought cannot be imagined. Formerly a man did not dare to think freely. Now he dares, but cannot. His will to think is only a willingness to think to order, and this is what he feels as his liberty. 21. Spengler died in 1936, before the utter destruction of World War II would give additional breadth to his gloomy vision of civilizational decline, and before European post-war reconstruction, with its popular arts, cinema glamour, and prosperity, would, in more subtle ways, verify his observations. Actually, Spengler's words about the press would provide a vivid account of how Julius Streicher's virulently anti-Semitic newspaper Der Stürmer played a central role in stirring up Nazi mobs against the Jews in the late 1930s and beyond. And Spengler's fears about the media still have resonance in America today, however more nuanced and less lethal have become the examples of this. Who can deny, for example, the sheer cultural and political power of the New York Times? Or Fox News, for that matter? No senator's speech or revelatory book even has the ability to move the needle on public opinion like a well-placed story, purportedly about news, but in fact barely masking an opinion, appearing on the New York Times homepage or in prime time on Fox. Of course, the Times is professional in just so many ways that Fox is not, making it ultimately less lethal. Nevertheless, their points of view in both cases have drifted away from the strict middle ground in the aftermath of the print and typewriter age. In fact, the press, or the media I should say, is more powerful now than ever in history because of the vividness of words and images as they flash on smartphones or computer screens in the digital video age, an age which incorporates the Hollywood mindset of manipulating reality in order to distort how we think about the great issues of the day, replete with rumors, exaggerations, and character assassination. For it is impossible to imagine our present political polarization except in the age of internet news, which drives people to sites of extreme opinions that validate their pre-existing prejudices, turning them into mobs. 22. And digital video technology, precisely because it is given to manipulation, is inherently controlling. Think of how the great film directors of the 20th century were able to take over your mind for a few hours, a new experience for audiences that previous generations had never known. Theater may be as old as the ancient Greeks, but, once again, it has been the new technology that has amplified the force of the theatrical experience. 23. Spengler intuited this with his fear of the media and what it could potentially become. Combine the urban horde that Spengler so well described with the mass media of today and the results can be frightening. All of this applies not only to the United States but to countries throughout the world, where public opinion regularly becomes inflamed on account of the new media technology. Such inflammation can have its positive effect, sure, as when the deployment of social media challenges dictatorships, Chinese citizens protesting extreme COVID restrictions, or Iranian citizens protesting the mandatory use of the hijab. Yet the mob principle still holds. Some mobs will do good, it goes without saying. But the future will naturally be one of different kinds of mobs, forming and reforming, owing to technology and urbanization, since most of us already live in cities and crowded suburbs, and this will be more so in the decades to come, as people in the developing world will increasingly live in slum encampments on the outskirts of cities, yet connected to the world through their devices. And that will create an altered dynamic to history. Observe the surge of public hysteria, expressed through social media, that occurs in cities throughout India and Pakistan whenever geopolitical tensions rise in the nuclear-armed Asian subcontinent. The point is to see social media and digital video technology not in isolation, but in combination with other geopolitical forces, such as urbanization and weaponry. Unlike thermonuclear warheads, the new weaponry hypersonic missiles, precision-guided bombs, small-scale tactical nuclear weapons are designed to be actually used. Consider the mix of such munitions controlled by governments that are besieged by their own social media enraged populations, not only in democracies, but also in dictatorships, where the very lack of political freedom can make people at key moments even more prone to rebellion. This is where it gets scary, making Spengler's passages resonate. Spengler's broad concept of civilizational decline, linked to the influence of the media but not exclusively to it, is akin to that of the medieval Arab scholar Abd al-Rahman ibn Khaldun's own famous theory, expressed in the latter's Muqaddimah, An Introduction to History. Ibn Khaldun, born in 1332, was a writer, thinker, traveler, and historian of the caliber of the Italian Renaissance, though he lived in North Africa. He advised sultans and ministers not only in his native Tunis but also in the courts of Moorish Spain and the Maghreb, as Morocco was then known. His great idea about history begins with the Bedouin, with whom he was so familiar, since the desert is the basis and reservoir of civilization and cities. This is true because before there can be luxury and opulence there must be the bare necessities, which the Bedouin restrict themselves to, until, over time, they become strong enough to become sedentary themselves and infiltrate cities and towns, or start them on their own. Ibn Khaldun observed that whereas the Bedouin aspired to sedentary life in the town, the townspeople had no such aspiration regarding life in the wilderness. Thus, the pattern of history was established in his mind. It is one of nomads gradually moving into the towns and thus building dynasties of their own, until they, too, become wealthy and soft in their ways and are overtaken by new and different nomads. This is, broadly speaking, how dynasties decay, as they have a natural lifespan like individuals. Luxury leads to strength initially, with its arts and money and power, but then decadence sets in, and the provincials, sensing weakness, attack the basis of city life and its morals. 24. Thus, before there was a Spengler there was an Ibn Khaldun. As Spengler explains it, any large group operates as an organism, which is born, grows old, and dies. The highest form of group achievement constitutes civilization, which represents the fulfillment and finale of a culture, before it deteriorates and crumbles. 25 That is, cultures become increasingly wealthy and sophisticated over the decades and centuries, producing great works of art and learning, and in the process become themselves decadent and therefore weak, and are then overtaken by other cultures, or by Bedouin tribes assaulting the city, in Ibn Khaldun's rendering. These nomads, arguably akin to Spengler's folk, who assault the centers of civilization, are particularly aggressive and sure of themselves, and in the long story of their subsequent growth and cultural development they repeat the cycle, as they, too, become civilized. There is a vague allegory here with the red states assaulting the blue ones. But people from rural Kansas and such are not moving to New York and taking over with their conservative values. That's not what's really implied for our own age in Spengler and Ibn Khaldun. Indeed, it has been quite common for many decades now for artists and writers from the interior of America or other conservative quarters to move to places like New York, live out their lives there, and adopt wholeheartedly the values of a cosmopolitan worldview. Andy Warhol from Pittsburgh, William Starin from various places in the South, and Calvin Trillin from Kansas City are just a few of a plethora of examples of artists who came to the big city and changed accordingly, or became their true, inner selves. Because America is a democratic union, the assault from the less culturally sophisticated, conservative quarters on the cosmopolitan bastions like New York is occurring in the realm of national politics only, through the media. Thus, in a political sense, the countryside is assailing the city, which has grown effete in the course of many decades of luxury and cultural refinement. Who will win this epic battle that has been building for several election cycles? I don't know. But I do know that the drama is principally playing out in and being interpreted by a cosmopolitan media located in the great cities. It is all about the cities, in fact, what they have become, and the negative reaction to them in what F. Scott Fitzgerald famously called that vast obscurity where the dark fields of the Republic rolled on under the night. 26. For Spengler, the city is the world, where the decline of the West is indeed happening before one's eyes. The city with its media was the stage set for Spengler's entire theory, and more vaguely I.B.N. Caldun's for that matter, and for the growth, maturation, decadence, and decline of many a culture, since Spengler clearly sees the city, and each upscale mall when you get right down to it, as representing both the apex and downfall of man. I witnessed this most intensely in the communist expanse of Central and Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union in the 1980s and post-communist 1990s, where the cities were vibrant and the rural hinterlands were zones of alcoholism, near chaos, and brutal underdevelopment, so that these places weren't countries so much as city-states, separated from each other by limitless zones of darkness, in which fabulous wealth accumulated within a radius of a few square miles in a short-lived era of Klondike capitalism, before the effect of European Union membership began to stabilize and even out development in Central and Eastern Europe. Russia, of course, is still afflicted by this extreme version of Spengler's vision. One of the many reasons the West is the West is that its rural hinterlands, increasingly encroached upon by suburbs and exurbs, are nice places to live, where roads, schools, and hospitals are decent, even if the culture lacks the sophistication of the metropole, and even though the towns inhabit the nation-state, while the cities inhabit world civilization. It is the very development of infrastructure in the rural precincts of the West that allows for its glamorous cities in the first place, outside the West, where people flee en masse their underdeveloped hinterlands without economic opportunities, cities are both fringed and compromised, with vast slums and shanty towns, which function as way stations for the rural migrants as they fight for employment in the cities. One reason why there are more and more megacities is because of this uneven development. Spengler doesn't discuss any of this because he died in 1916, long before the rise and fall of communism in Central and Eastern Europe, and before globalization, whose bad side effects have included new shanty towns with relatively poor infrastructure of electricity and potable water across the developing world, especially in Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa. Yet all of this actually works to intensify Spengler's strategic emphasis on the world city and its pathologies. For the world city, with its access to the internet, whether in a luxury high-rise or a slum, is a place of global culture and the intense yearning for more of it that undermine the nation-state. Inside the world city, as we know, is the press, as Spengler calls it, which embodies, in turn, the tip of the spear in terms of civilizational decline of which the city is the heart. Here is where urbanity and the original liberal hopes associated with it, especially those of Jane Jacobs, begin to turn in upon themselves, as the press, by leading the masses by the neck in terms of political and cultural values, becomes the foremost incubator of the mob, even as the folk rebel against it. Style, which the elite newspapers and other periodicals are ultimately all about, especially in their glossy magazine sections that often go under the very name, is ultimately the enemy of civilization and the agent of its eventual demise. This is because, in both Spengler's and I.B.N. Caldun's interpretation, style indicates the ultimate refinement of the body, with all its clothes and jewelry and perfume, where appearances are everything and substance consequently nothing. This, of course, leads to the worship of youth over age, despite the acquired wisdom of the latter, since youth is by biological definition physically beautiful and age consequently not so. Such is the height of civilization, and the beginning of its drawn-out regression, Spengler and Ibn Khaldun suggest. The triumph of youth over age, rather than leading to hope, as conventional wisdom has it, leads instead to disintegration. Of course, in demographic terms we are an aging society, but in culture and media terms the emphasis is increasingly on youth. I remember a New York Times reporter showing me a memo he had received from a top editor, exhorting his subordinates to appeal in every story and review to new young readers. The top editor appeared unaware of how age carries the memories of a culture with all of its traditions, in which youth has first to be instructed. To put youth on an even higher pedestal, therefore, is to destroy civilization. And yet that is what the news and advertising media do. Spengler was a dark and moody German conservative, and thus he is not an altogether objective interpreter. Remember, however, that as the philosopher Roger Scruton has observed, conservatism is about home and hearth and tradition as an anchor in society, to save us all from becoming atomic individuals, disinfected of the past, and living like ants within their metallic and functional shells, a reference to the traditionless modern architecture so central to the city of the 21st century that Scruton hates so much and cannot escape from, because it is just there, unavoidable. 27. Spengler and Scruton both, as well as Solzhenitsyn, who hated the worship of youth and felt that the downfall of the Russian royal family, whatever its iniquities, meant the loss of tradition that led inevitably to the Bolshevik nightmare, all worry that the pillars of civilization are being pulled down by modernism and postmodernism, with chaos and fragmentation in their wake. Remember that Solzhenitsyn was like Pope John Paul II in that both were as critical of the West as of their own communist societies. Spengler says that without traditions, which ultimately are rooted in the soil, a nation or civilization loses form. The most obvious sign of an advanced civilization losing form is its takeover by the money culture in the cities, which has little sense of a past and where it came from, and little concern either. 29. The money culture of bankers, stockbrokers, real estate entrepreneurs, media moguls, and their like goes hand in hand with the overseas adventures of imperialism, which together signify the end of the West. While empire in historical terms may have been politically stabilizing, the fall of the Hohenzollern and Habsburg empires gave us Hitler. The process of accumulating imperial possessions leads to decadence and decline, according to Spengler. This is because extreme concentrations of wealth in the cities can be a sign of extraordinary state power, which, in turn, tempts nations and states to go abroad both to extend that power and to protect their interests, which, by virtue of the very existence of their money cultures, are now international. Washington think tanks, too, are part of the money culture, as their operating funds come from corporate donations as well as from extremely wealthy individuals. And lo and behold, such think tanks often advocate military adventures abroad, in one form or another, just and unjust. It makes no difference for our purposes, since imperialism is often implicit rather than explicit. To wit, the word imperialism is disparaged in the United States, even as America has been in an imperial-like situation since 1945. All this isn't true just of New York and Washington, but also of medieval Venice, the early modern Netherlands, and many other empires made up of bankers, adventurers, and all manner of slick operators. The civilization in question has triumphed, in other words, and there is often nowhere to go but down, as its power brokers, who in America's case come from all over the world, as immigrants and ambitious passport seekers, have only a vague sense of a past that originated with sod busters deep inside the American continent in the course of the 19th century. The continuity has been lost. That is why imperialism is both the height and the end of the line of great civilizations. Indeed, nobody can deny that the American Empire from the close of World War II to the early 21st century has been grand, in terms of preserving a semblance of world order. but as America's relative share of global wealth has gradually declined, and the world as I've described it has become increasingly unmanageable, we may well be on a downward trajectory. For this is the heart of Spengler's story, even if he rarely discusses America. Spengler would look at skyrocketing Manhattan property values over the course of the decades, military adventures in Afghanistan and Iraq, and Pentagon arms buildups against China and Russia, and yawn, for he had seen it all before in his voluminous studies of wars and civilizations spanning the millennia. This does not mean that America is wrong to rise to the challenge of a more aggressive China and Russia, only that it contributes to a larger historical effect that can be tragic for America. Spengler, through it all, is the ultimate generalist, seeing history from a godlike height and span, mixing and matching historical periods of empires and dynasties across the globe, talking about the Gothic period of China, the Merovingian period of Babylon, and so forth. His perspective has perhaps never been equaled. That is because his education, by choice, was horizontal rather than vertical. He studied a vast variety of subjects in history, science, geography, and culture, literally without the time to pursue any one of them toward the type of advanced degree qualifying him in the eyes of his peers as an expert. We often talk about the benefits of a liberal arts education, well, Spengler gave himself the monumental version of one. He might well have looked down on the liberal arts in American colleges, even in their glory days of the post-World War II era, as still too narrow. Now, obviously, we have gone over to the other extreme, where we inhabit a world populated by specialists with exceedingly stovepiped visions of reality, who are therefore apt to have poorer judgment than the widely read Spengler. And this poorer judgment, multiplied across the population especially among the elites, makes for an innumerable debris of bad decisions subtly weakening our civilization, and there is little any of us can do about it, because we can't put our finger exactly on it. After all, as knowledge accumulates in so many fields, expertise provides the only way forward. We simply cannot avoid it. And yet a regime of experts risks constituting an indefinable darkness, since experts can periodically be wrong and themselves subject to groupthink. That's why, as messy and unsatisfying as politics can be, there is no escape from being governed by politicians rather than by experts. Spengler goes on with his thesis of civilizational decline. He writes that the gleaming autumn of style signifies a culture just before it begins its long death throes, since an obsession with refined taste, as we've said, is the beginning of decadence. And the arts, it also goes without saying, are urban and therefore secular, because true religious belief is absent in the great world cities, which have insufficient soil ties. Spengler writes rapturously, Dresden and Vienna are the homes of this late and soon extinguished fairyland of visible chamber music, of curved furniture and mirror halls, and porcelain. It is the last supreme expression, lit by an autumnal sun, of the Western soul. Notice, everything that succeeds early and mid-19th century chamber music, be it the impressionism of great composers like Debussy and Saint-Saëns, the breakthrough modernism of Stravinsky, or the great American songbook epitomized by Rodgers and Hammerstein and Stephen Sondheim, denotes a cultural decline, however stirring, however beautiful, moving, and innovative it may be. Even such a classic as West Side Story, with lyrics by Sondheim and music by Leonard Bernstein, which broke the boundaries of popular music, and came at the height of the American century and American power much as Sophocles' searing tragedy Oedipus Rex came at the height of Athenian power, probably would not have impressed Spengler, as it would still have signified a regression from the likes of Franz Schubert and Ludwig van Beethoven. For Spengler's context is nothing less than the vast historical and cultural flows of centuries and millennia. Thus, to continue the point, such a classic American musical as Oklahoma, which helped rally the home front during World War II, is, alas, something crude and simplistic compared to the delicate movements of Robert Schumann and Felix Mendelssohn. Spengler is not crazy, much as we'd like to think so, it is just that his perspective is so long as to be inhuman. As for painting, anything after the likes of Manet and Cézanne is impotence and falsehood, at least in Spengler's view. In 1918, Spengler actually wrote that every single art school could be shut down without art being affected in the slightest. Nothing, therefore, punctuates the centuries-long decline of the West like modern art, because, among other things and like the climax of civilization itself, modern art is tied to the abstractions of the city and despises any link to the land. And whatever disconnects itself from the land becomes rigid and, in the final analysis, ideological. The late journalist and novelist Tom Wolfe comprehended some of this in his book The Painted Word, Iris. Wolfe wrote that painting in the course of the 20th century had become not a visual experience but a visual illustration of theories of art propounded by a select group of critics. In fact, he wrote, the art world had become dominated by a narrow and limited, fiber-urban group of wealthy collectors, museums located in superstar cities, and a handful of influential critics, who together determined what people saw in galleries and museums. Modern art was also something else. It was about Freudian introspection, decomposition, and African as well as American, and Asian as well as European forms. And that, of course, can be liberating. But because it owed little to geographical limits, and thus even less to American and European landscapes, it had freed itself from deep soil ties that Spengler extols. On one crucial level, Spengler is wrong. One of the greatest museums I have ever visited is Peggy Guggenheim's collection of modern art located on the Grand Canal in Venice, which displays the works of Pablo Picasso, Constantin Brancusi, Max Ernst, Paul Klee, Vasily Kandinsky, Andy Warhol, and more. What Spengler obviously misses is that there is a progression beyond European art and culture that is not necessarily decadent. This progression, by being abstract, and by encompassing other traditions, manifests a direction toward a universal aesthetic that is, in turn, evidence of a smaller and more connected world. And that world, precisely by being smaller and connected, is inherently tumultuous and unstable. So Spengler, even as he is a reactionary in terms of art and culture, contributes to my point about geopolitics. The soil ties that Spengler extols were lost with the machine age before his book appeared. Witness Igor Stravinsky's ballet and orchestral concert The Rite of Spring, first heard and performed in Paris in 1913, on the eve of World War I, though virtually nobody foresaw war at the time. The music was jarring. It lacked ornamentation, moral intimation, and even, for the most part, melody, writes the Latvian-born Canadian historian and cultural critic Madris Eksteins. There was a brutality about the music, he goes on. If there was any hope, it was in the energy and fertility of life, not in morality. 3. The audience was shocked by the music, which, as T.S. Eliot put it, seemed to transform the rhythm of the steps into the scream of the motor horn, the rattle of machinery, the grind of wheels, the beating of iron and steel, the roar of the underground railway, and the other barbaric cries of modern life. Like Stravinsky, Eliot may actually have been more hopeful than Spengler. Spengler is without any uplifting beauty, unlike Eliot. But Eliot was also fearful of the future. In 1913, when Stravinsky's Rite of Spring was first performed, Eliot was just starting to burst forth as a writer. In time, with his grand allusions to technology and historical fate, he would tower above virtually the entire canon of American and British poetry in the 20th century, so much of which was strictly confessional and introverted, with the spellbinding interiority of Robert Frost's landscape poetry being the great exception. Eliot, by helping to invent poetic modernism, saw through the transparencies of the modern world to its message of alienation underneath. To Eliot, the modern world was an immense panorama of futility and anarchy, a pile of fragments. 33. Whereas the Austrian Rainer Maria Rilke, a near contemporary of Eliot, whose own work with its dizzying introspection spanned the borders of Europe and escaped geography, embodied the poetic miracle which rose above the masses, it was Eliot, the poetic realist, who dealt with the effect of war and history upon the masses. 34. Eliot's poem The Waste Land, published in 1922, the same year as Spengler's second volume of The Decline of the West, was famously all about the breakdown of forms, the intermingling of epochs, languages, and traditions and the destruction of unitary cultures that had been rooted in the soil. The poem, written in the aftermath of one world war and before another, ends with an apocalypse, and yet its discontinuities feel like home, according to the contemporary critic James Parker, on account of the crises of the world today at the geopolitical level and postmodern life at the micro level. 6. The Wasteland is a poem that begins with a vision of idyllic aristocratic life in Europe that is wiped out by World War I, leaving only a dead imprint of stony rubbish in its wake, a heap of broken images, and ends after a kaleidoscopic tour of mystifying symbols, with the repetition of a Sanskrit word, shanta, that implies the peace that passeth all understanding. In between are five sections: the burial of the dead, a game of chess, the fire sermon, death by water, and what the thunder said, that are themselves laden with obscure literary and classical analogies, a tarot reading, a walk through London as if through a city of the dead, the absence of water and only dry rock in the landscape, and hooded hordes swarming. He writes, a crowd flowed under London Bridge, so many / I had not thought death had undone so many. It is almost impossible for the layman to understand exactly what is going on in the poem, and critics have argued about its line-by-line meaning for a century now. The poem works, though. It reads like a sweaty, nightmarish dream forgotten instantly upon waking. And yet the abstract horror of it endures and has been integrated almost into the popular culture on account of its underlying power, which, in turn, relies on its uncanny echo of our own disjointed, anarchy-bordering crises, political, cultural, and psychological. As the narrator says near the end, before reciting the Sanskrit incantation, these fragments I have shored against my ruins. 37. Not only in The Wasteland, but in his earlier breakthrough poems, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock and Geronchin, Eliot employs the thematic backdrop of vast, bleak, cosmopolitan, and alienating unreal cities to describe the modern dilemma, and to expose the postmodern one, too. 8. The mid-20th century American poet Delmore Schwartz writes that modern life may be compared to a foreign country in which a foreign language is spoken, incomprehensible to us, but not to Eliot, who has described this new world where, as Schwartz intimates, national culture has been eradicated but international culture is still too superficial to take its place, as occurs in the world's great cities today. This is The Wasteland. 39. Eliot and Spengler were contemporaries, and though one was a poet and the other a philosopher-historian, they were really talking about the same thing, the decline and breakdown of traditional civilizations based on language and geography. Post-World War I literary modernism, as exemplified by Eliot and his editor for The Wasteland, Ezra Pound, was really only the first stage of literature coming to grips with breakdown and collapse. The second stage came after World War II, famously with the existentialist French writers Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus. Existentialism was a response to the emergency of daily life in the modern world, expressed through a precise detailing of one's thoughts on paper, page after page, wrote the poet and critic Hayden Carruth. Reality, according to the existentialists, can only be what one individual knows and experiences. 40. Thus, a crowd, or mob, or folk is by definition untruth. Whereas Eliot's poetry was about panoramic political and cultural failure, French existentialism was about the neurosis of personal life. It constituted a drilling down from civilization and culture to the level of the singular human being. It was, in part, a response to the Holocaust and the wider devastation of World War II, which had worked to erase the individual altogether. Indeed, in their fiction both Sartre and Camus are able to explain the most abstract of concepts through the lives of average, even pathetic, individuals. Like few other writers save for James Joyce and Henry James, for example, Sartre and Camus capture human consciousness and stream of thought, even those of criminals. That is why their fiction is so central to their philosophy. They were intellectuals who nevertheless understood common people and their problems, however radical and unrealistic Sartre's own far-left politics may have been. Finally, we have the post, Cold War era mixed with the age of digital and cyber technology, which began in 1989 and really gathered steam in the early 21st century. Because of the way that the cyber and digital age both enrich and intensify individual experience and consciousness, and because of a new technological ability for individuals to network with each other below the threshold of political authority so that they can challenge prevailing power structures, the current age demonstrates an obsession with self, evinced by anxiety on one hand and identity politics on the other. From Eliot's civilizational breakdown to Sartre's breakdowns of neurotic individuals, mixed with the discovery of individual agency, we now have the chaos of anxiety-ridden individuals, again, obsessed with self, coming together in new crowd formations. The spectacle at the New York Times, where a digital mob sought to end the career of two eminently experienced and liberal editors, had been, in cultural and civilizational terms, decades in the making. So too might be the throngs of elite college students gathering together in packed encampments to, in effect, support Hamas, despite its October 7, 2023, atrocity against Jews. Consider all of the above in light of the human geography of the 21st century: vast, technologically connected metroplexes, cities and suburbs both, particularly but not exclusively in the West, with their own adjacent hinterlands for weekend retreats, where religion has been replaced by exercise and consumerism. Jane Jacobs's liberal vision of the vibrant sidewalk of different classes fights for survival, while the conservative Roger Scruton is appalled about humans living like ants within their metallic and functional shells. Forget about wide open spaces. They will exist mainly for tourism. By 2050, virtually the entire population of Arizona will live in the greater Tucson-Phoenix urban-suburban corridor. The United States as a whole is overwhelmingly urban, with 83% of its population now living in cities and their immediate environs. In China, 65% of the population is urban, in Russia, 75%. These figures will go on rising. The urbanist Richard Florida writes, "Over the next century or two, the world's urban population is projected to almost triple, peaking at 85% of a total global population of between 2 and 12 billion. As many as 8.6 billion of those urbanites will live in the cities of the developing world, many of which have yet to be built, while just 1.2 billion or so will occupy the cities of the advanced nations." Though his figures are too high, as world population will peak below 11 billion, his larger point is accurate. In sub-Saharan Africa, 85% of the population will eventually live in the cities in a number of countries. The bush, or forest, or savanna will only partially define Africa. Much of the political drama will play out in the slums and shanty towns occupied by the ruralized urban poor, not just in Africa, but in the Asian subcontinent and Latin America, too. Migrants from the countryside, who, despite the superficially ugly and overcrowded conditions, with dwellings of sheet iron and breeze block all jumbled together, will still believe there is more economic opportunity close to the capital or big city. This was the world I introduced readers to in The Coming Anarchy over 3 decades ago. It is a world of intense human striving, of self-help organizations, committees, petitioners, for these are the ambitious ones, who have deserted the dead-end existences of the far-flung villages plagued by militias and other lawless bands. Yet the conditions in these shanty towns can be really bad: uncertain electricity, uncertain plumbing, dirty water, bad air, and the plague of sheer overcrowding. Then there are the youth gangs, shakedown artists, and other such who exist by virtue of the absence or insufficiency of proper police. These places can be wastelands in a different sense than in the high-end conurbations of the West and developed world. Say can be, because it all depends on the human interactions and what encourages them. If the degree of aggression and intimidation is reasonably low, and opportunities exist for enough of the inhabitants, such shanty towns can be way stations to the working and middle classes, as I observed in Turkish slums in the 1990s. What unites African slums with the Tony cities and suburbs of the West is the perennial struggle to avoid the intimidating pressures of groupthink and giving in to the bully's physical or intellectual, while at the same time retaining the ability to work together for social and economic betterment. Whether a young tough demands a bribe or an editor or digital mob demands conformist language from you in order for you to keep your job, it may amount to a similar level of evil. The cities, because of their crowded conditions, are an intensification of existence and therefore of politics. Even if you don't buy Spengler's argument or Malthus's or buy only parts of them, and find only parts of them relevant, they should at least make you nervous given the demographics of the 21st century. Nobody will declare his or her views as driven by ideological abstraction and crowd psychology because he or she happens to live in a teeming urban setting or an architecturally and socially conformist suburban one. But it will be there, just below the surface, having its effect, multiplied by billions. It is a conceit of the modern world, to repeat Solzhenitsyn, that history is governed by reason. The French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, Kristallnacht, Maoist China's Cultural Revolution, and the Iranian Revolution are some examples of the madness of urban crowds coupled with the irresistibility of extremism that helped to give early modern and modern history their horrifying direction. Even in the United States, urban riots, which can be motivated by a demand for racial justice, contain a violent edge that has, in turn, for better and sometimes for worse, dramatically affected the course of domestic politics. Urban riots are almost always a common element in regime crises, and not only in the developing world with ever larger cities. The 21st century, in other words, will be increasingly tumultuous. Indeed, the heart of dictatorship is to prevent the formation of spontaneous crowds, which can form more easily than ever before because of social media technology. The crowd. Solzhenitsyn writes. A strange special being, both human and inhuman, where each individual was released from his usual responsibility and was multiplied in strength. The psychology of the crowd, or mob, is thus, show us who next to tear to pieces 43. Though technology has kept evolving, the roots of the permanent crisis in the 21st century continue to lie in what went wrong in the 20th. Nazism and communism shared two decisive elements, the safety of the crowd and the yearning for purity. I remember being in Bucharest, Romania, in November 1981, observing immense crowds of people, marching in the freezing cold, shouting, Ceausescu, pace, Ceausescu, pace, Ceausescu, peace, Ceausescu, peace. They were demanding peace and nuclear disarmament, while also celebrating the totalitarian dictator. Moral purity and blind obedience were the messages of the crowd. Sacred tradition, which cannot be contrived or learned, according to the great British translator of Russian literature Max Hayward, had been utterly destroyed by the Stalinist dictator of Romania, and in its place was socialist progress, like the mechanical movement of a clock hand, proclaiming that the future has only one direction. Such mindless crowds cast off all humanizing and historical tradition, including religion, and thus give themselves up to ideology in one form or another. They do this by destroying the memory and existence of the individual, who, being an individual, may deviate from the political direction demanded by the crowd. In Crowds and Power, first published in German in 1960, the Bulgarian Jewish philosopher Elias Canetti may have written the most intuitive book about the crisis of the West over the past 100 years. Spengler's tome argues that Western civilization, like all civilizations, is ultimately ephemeral and tied to the development of the city. Canetti's book explains the actual mechanics of this decline. Canetti, like Hannah Arendt, wrote in the immediate wake of the ravages of Nazism and Stalinism and had an especial knack about the present and future. Canetti won the Nobel Prize in Literature mainly for this book, which I first read in paperback in Stalinist Romania, where I encountered some of the very sorts of crowds Canetti wrote about. He and Arendt both understood that the worst tyrannies had their origins in the isolation and loneliness of the individual, which leads to the most fearsome crowd formations. That is, as we shall see, the mob is made up of lonely people. Canetti's early work of fiction, Auto da Fe, lays the groundwork for Crowds and Power by dissecting the neurosis of a man who lives alone, entirely for his library, since for him books have replaced human beings. He has minimal contact with others and is tormented by his housekeeper. You draw closer to the truth by shutting yourself off from mankind. The greatest danger which threatens a man of learning is to lose himself in talk. He panted for silence as others do for air. 45. This, of course, is the profile of a man who prefers to be alone. After all, he is mentally enriched by his books and learning. But the vast majority of people want to escape their loneliness and be one with others. Canetti, who has explored loneliness in all its aspects, and from all directions, is best prepared to explore the phenomenon of the crowd. The crowd, Canetti writes, emerges from the need of the lonely individual to conform with others. He wants to lose himself and escape from his isolation by literally rubbing shoulders with others, and feeling the breath of others upon his neck. It is only within the crowd that he can escape the innate human fear of being touched by a stranger. Because he can't exert dominance on his own, he exerts it through a crowd that speaks with one voice. He was nothing before the creation of this crowd and now he is everything. The crowd's urge is always to grow, rescuing others from their loneliness, and consuming all hierarchies, since the goal of a lonely individual is always to be noticed and to dominate his betters. Within the crowd there is equality, Canetti emphasizes. Yet the crowd feels persecuted and demands retribution, because lonely individuals are always bitter about something. Thus, the crowd sees itself as entirely pure, having attained the highest virtue. After all, the lonely individual, in his own thoughts at least, can do no wrong. And he receives justification of this inside the crowd, where for the first time he feels he has power. This is how tyranny begins. A principal aim of the crowd is to hunt down the insufficiently virtuous, like those on the wrong side of history, because, after all, to pronounce someone as such is to presume to know the direction of history, a category of knowledge not given to anyone. For even those who fight against the most abject despotisms can't be sure how events will turn out. All they can do is struggle. To claim categorically to know the future, therefore, falls within the realm of ideology, of which the crowd, or mob, is a principal weapon. Canetti as a writer is as relentless and obsessive as the crowds he describes, breaking them down and cataloging them over the course of more than 500 pages. The original crowd crystal, he writes, was the pack, a small horde or band of 10 or 20 men, engaged often in hunting, which in prehistory was the universal expression of communal excitement. Derivative of the hunting pack is the baiting crowd. The victim here is known and clearly marked. The victim is also near, and the crowd won't rest or disband until the victim is killed or punished in some way. The existence of the baiting crowd leads to the phenomenon of public executions, which are connected to the practice of collective killing. The real executioner is the crowd gathered round the scaffold, Canetti writes. The most primitive of all crowd packs engaged in collective killing is the lynch mob, which thinks itself human only because its members do not actually sink their teeth into the victim. The victim here looks different from the crowd. He is clearly not one of them. And the fact that he runs away increases the bloodlust of the crowd when its members find him. Thus does racism in the American South have the most primitive roots. Even inflation, Canetti declares, is a crowd phenomenon, since as the unit of money loses its value and identity, the individuals who own it feel depreciated, and as they cannot admit their own depreciation to themselves, a crowd comes into being that finds a victim for such depreciation, a scapegoat. The inflation in Germany that helped bring Hitler to power was one of the most extreme in economic history. And the victim that the crowd chose for vengeance was the Jews, who were seen to be on good terms with money when others did not know how to manage it, and thus were a natural target for the crowd to shift all the blame onto. Canetti, throughout this book, is essentially explaining many of the worst evils of history and how they could come about through the phenomenon of crowds. But he also writes about many kinds of crowds that are not evil, such as reversal crowds. He explains that revolutions are times of reversal, those who have been defenseless for so long suddenly find teeth. Depending upon the circumstances, this can be either good or bad. Again, The crowd, in Canetti's eyes, helps form the bedrock of the human experience, with an especial emphasis on the dark side. 47. The tyranny of the crowd has many other aspects, but Canetti says its most blatant and riveting form is that of the questioner, that is, of the accuser. When used as an intrusion of power, the accusing crowd is like a knife cutting into the flesh of the victim. The questioner knows what there is to find, but he wants actually to touch it and bring it to light. Naturally, the more hostile the questions, the greater the delight of the crowd. 8 Congressional hearings on both sides of the political divide have over the years and decades become an increasingly vivid example of this, rising to the level of spectacle. Though perhaps the greatest spectacle of absolute madness abetted by crowd psychology occurred in the late 1940s and 1950s when Congress, under the baleful influence of Wisconsin Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy, orchestrated a witch hunt against U.S. diplomats and other area specialists, who it accused of leading a communist conspiracy that resulted in the loss of China to Mao Zedong's forces. Such episodes may find a renewed echo in an age when technology encourages intellectual mobs. 49. There are echoes and connections to much of this in George Orwell's 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, which, though considered outrageous by many when they were first published in 1949 and 1932, respectively, have attained an increasing aura of reality as the years go on and our society evolves in disturbing directions. As Julia, a character in 1984, says, "Always yell with the crowd, that's what I say. It's the only way to be safe." Even though Julia understands that all she reads and hears from the authorities and from the crowd is rubbish, she knew when to cheer and when to boo, and that was all one needed. 50. 1984 depicts a totalitarian society where the past is always being rewritten to conform with the reigning opinions of the present. The past and the people who populated the past are not allowed to be judged by the standards of their own era, with all of their moral strengths and defects, but only by the rules and standards of today. The past, thus, is in a crucial way eliminated. Chaucer, Shakespeare, Milton, Byron are no longer read in the original, but changed into something contradictory of what they used to be to suit the demands of the crowd. In fact, there is no past in Orwell's fictional society. The past was erased, the erasure was forgotten, the lie became truth. All ignorance flowed from this fact, since it is only by knowing what has come before, and the values and assumptions that previous generations used to live by what worked in those days and what didn't that any society could have any hope of a mature perspective on its current challenges. Yet, as Orwell tells us, history has stopped. Nothing exists except an endless present, as one breathless news cycle replaces the next, with no one looking back over their shoulder for any perspective or meaning. 5 Huxley, in Brave New World, depicts how new forms of drunkenness will enable future society in this endless present to exist in a state of partial or permanent tranquilization, subsisting on movies, gutter journalism, trashy music, and the like. It is the landscape of shattered glass depicted in Eliot's The Waste Land. This is where Spengler and Canetti come together with Orwell and Huxley. By any standards imaginable, the world that Orwell and Huxley describe signifies Spengler's decline of the West and Canetti's tyranny of the crowd. This is all happening and starting to happen before our eyes. We see it in how literature and the liberal arts at large are being dramatically undermined by ideology, so that only one interpretation is allowed, how individualism is being assaulted by fads and trends and viral tweets and videos and such, how a suite of pills are required for even well-balanced and successful people to sleep at night and relax during the day, and how journalism is becoming more ideological on one hand and trashier on the other hand, especially the cable news shows on daytime television. And all this is to say nothing about the looming ability of artificial intelligence, and programmers thereof, to unleash whole new levels of coercive, conformist thinking. The first among equals in all of this is Canetti's crowd, which is the vehicle for both civilizational decline and individual coercion. And it is Canetti, perhaps more than any other modern writer, who has isolated crowd psychology as an intellectual subject all its own. Crowds, as Conetti shows in his description of the hunting pack, have existed since the dawn of time. Citizens in a well-functioning democracy do not constitute a crowd in the sense that Conetti means, since democracy involves individual choice in the privacy of the voting booth, where the crowd cannot intimidate you since nobody knows in the end which lever you will pull, or which candidate you will check off. Despite all the riotous rallies of the campaign, it comes down to a secret act. And that is to the good. Assuming that the winning majority has reasonable respect for the losing minority, democracy actually demonstrates the limits of crowd coercion. Yet there is still a danger, since modern and postmodern technology, first newspapers and radio, now X and Facebook, has created untold vistas for the tyranny of the crowd. And this can subvert the spirit of democracy. Indeed, we think we are more tolerant and civilized because of technology. But technology and civilization are two different things, not necessarily opposed, but not necessarily in harmony, either. The demons behind World War I and World War II demonstrated how technological advances, the triumphs of industrialization employed for the purposes of war and mass killing, can be conducive to barbarism. Technology can lead to a better world and more efficient democracy, sure. It all depends, to repeat, just look at what happened at the New York Times in 2020. The tyranny born of an assemblage of people had as its goal the destruction of two liberal individuals who hadn't sufficiently proved their virtue in the eyes of the crowd. The affair at the New York Times, merely one event inside a news cycle of George Floyd, related national drama, points to a pivotal difference between the 20th and 21st centuries. The 20th century was an age of mass communications, often controlled by big governments, so that ideology and its attendant intimidation were always delivered from the top down. Hitler, Stalin, and Mao can only be imagined in a 20th century context against the backdrop of the climax of the Industrial Revolution. The 21st century has produced an inversion of all this, whereby individuals can work through digital networks to gather together from the bottom up. This does not end tyranny from the top down, as we know from present-day Russia and China. But it does add another dimension to the battle in defense of free thought. Bottom-up crowds will obviously have various effects. They are a force behind bestseller and greatest hit lists. They can destroy reputations before the full truth emerges. They can reduce the presidential primary system to a contest of demagogues. They demonstrate, as the founders of the American Revolution knew, that unrestrained democracy is the proving ground of anarchy. But they can also be forces for good. The Arab Spring in 2011 in North Africa and the Middle East may have failed, but it began with hope for a less oppressive political future, and bottom-up crowds forged by social media were the primary cause of that. The uprisings against a brutal clerical regime in Iran in 2009 and 2022 could not have happened without the self-organizing, bottom-up crowd phenomenon of social media. One woman in Tehran in September 2022, Mahsa Amini, was brutalized and killed by so-called morality police for not properly wearing her hijab, and the news spread to this person and that one via social media, and built, until vast bottom-up demonstrations nearly rocked the regime in major cities. The point is that social and digital media in the world cities will ignite more domestic and geopolitical turbulence, even if it is periodically toward a good end against truly tyrannical regimes. Social media in the world cities are a key reason why politics will continue to get harder, more complicated, and more difficult to succeed at. It isn't only that highly populated and complex countries like Pakistan, Nigeria, and South Africa in the developing world have increasingly teetered on becoming failed states, rather, it is that it has gotten harder to govern countries like the United States and France, too. The populations in absolute terms get bigger and bigger, if not in every case. The people have more and more demands. Whereas countries of vast and illiterate peasantries can be quite stable, since the population is relatively fatalistic and consequently has fewer claims to make on politicians, the development of literate working and middle classes, though it counts as progress, can lead to instability, since the population is no longer fatalistic and expects more of government. Middle classes are just tougher to govern, something that cannot be helped, especially in democratic societies. This is as true in Nigeria and South Africa as it is in former communist Central and Eastern Europe. As Samuel P. Huntington bluntly put it, the faster the enlightenment of the population, the more frequent the overthrow of the government. 53. It isn't that the world is getting worse. It's getting better. More and more people live fuller and richer lives, and have more and better ways to communicate their feelings. And this makes governing them more difficult, even as they form into virtual crowds that, while professing independence, will operate on the basis of a brutal conformity. For the act of protest is not wholly innocent. It demands that a large group of people think as one in order to be organized. Whole populations, in the grip of some political frenzy or other, tapping feverishly on their smartphones in unison their approval or disapproval, will increasingly resemble the mores of teenage girls, in which the worst fear will be that of ostracism. The challenge is still one identified by both Conetti and Arendt, individual loneliness and atomization that creates blind obedience to crowds. For the crowd signals a rejection of reality in order to create an alternative reality, something that is doable provided a large number of people believe in it. This is something that technology itself can help with possibly frightening consequences. The future will be a contest of crowds, those imposing reality and those demanding a new reality. As for the effect of artificial intelligence on all of this, it will not be a panacea, but may only exacerbate the problem that these timeless philosophers raise. The former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, former Google CEO Eric Schmidt, and MIT College of Computing Dean Daniel Huttenlocher wrote in the Wall Street Journal that in the worlds of media, politics, discourse, and entertainment, AI will reshape information to conform to our preferences, potentially confirming and deepening biases, and, in so doing, narrowing access to an objective truth. 14. AI, because of its perceived omnipotence, could make it even harder to challenge acceptable opinion and conventional wisdom, and thus it can become a weapon of the ruling mob, like Google algorithms that not only pick winners and losers but merely amplify the lowest common denominator of popularity in the contest of ideas. AI, rather than a liberator, would in that case be an arm of authoritarianism. Like computing in general, AI's indisputable wonders will be in the fields of medicine, engineering, and other areas of science. But as it concerns democracy and mass society, AI's effects could be distinctly problematic. An elite few may control AI, a scientific mandarinate answerable to nobody, it will seem, even as AI becomes a third form of consciousness alongside secular thought and religious faith, according to Kissinger, Schmidt, and Huttenlocher. 55. AI could make judgments that, spread by social media, make it even more dangerous for those who wish to stand outside the crowd. While the tyranny that can be produced by bottom-up social media in many cases has a different style than top-down industrial-age authoritarianism, it has a similar result, the intimidation of dissent through a professed monopoly on virtue. If you don't agree with us, you are not only wrong but morally wanting, and as such should not only be denounced but destroyed. Remember, both Nazism and communism were utopian ideologies. In the minds of their believers they were systems of virtue, and precisely because of that they opened up new vistas for tyranny. Despite the passing of Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, tyranny, I repeat, is not done with us. And I am not just talking about Putin, Xi, and the other dictators who plague international relations, I am talking about new and subtler forms of coercion at home. It is the lust for purity and perfect virtue that, when combined with social media and other forms of communications technology, becomes particularly acute, since it puts power in the hands of the young, who are understandably more adaptable than their elders in the use of new cyber and digital products. This, too, raises the specter of particularly fearsome bottom-up mobs, since the young are not tempered by memories of the past and the grave mistakes they made in that past. The upshot of such crowd coercion is widespread self-censorship, the cornerstone of all forms of totalitarianism. Because the historic West is ultimately about the freedom of the individual to rise above the crowd, Spengler's theory of decline may be right for reasons even he doesn't mention. Of course, as we've seen, it can work the other way, too. Social media in Iran in the hands of the young can have the possibility of reinventing the West inside a reactionary religious tyranny. So while I am pointing out the dangers of the new technology and new types of crowd formations, I am, nevertheless, aware that it will also lead to positive breakthroughs. But in every case, it will make geopolitics more unpredictable and more tumultuous. Regimes, good and bad, throughout the world will be constantly in danger, contributing to a general anxiety and claustrophobia reminiscent of Weimar, where public life and politics were always in turmoil. And the two are entwined, since everything it seems is political now. The decline of the West began not only with the rise and elaboration of Eliot's bleak, unreal cities, delinked from the soil and beset by crowd frenzy, but with the birth of modernism itself, both of which are themes in the wasteland. 6. Modernism signaled indifference to, and independence from, the past, leading toward what the Marxists called progress and away from sacred traditions with their self-imposed limits, a process which encouraged disintegration and extremism. The very word modern suggests a dismissal of everything that comes before it as primitive in some way or other. Modernism was a breaking of the rules. Unmoored from the past and its sacred traditions, modern politics reinvented group, ethnic, and religious identities in starker, ideological terms. This counterintuitively released an instinctual power over politics that is, the release of raw emotions according to the Princeton historian of turn of the 20th century Vienna, Karl E. Skorsk. Remember that Vienna in that period produced not only the disturbing modern art of Gustav Klimt and Oskar Kokoschka, but the psychosexual theories of Sigmund Freud, and the ideological, mass-market anti-Semitism of Karl Lueger that would lead in a straight line to Adolf Hitler. In our 20th century, Skorsk writes, rational man has had to give place to that richer but more dangerous and mercurial creature, psychological man. This new man is not merely a rational animal, but a creature of feeling and instinct. 57. Being a creature of feeling and instinct, not only did racial politics, in the modern political sense, rise up under Vienna Mayor Karl Lueger, but also under that fierce pan-Germanist and anti-Semite, the Austrian politician George von Schönerer. Theodor Herzl, the father of political Zionism and another Viennese personality of the same period, was also, according to Skorsk, typical of the time, as Herzl's answer to anti-Semitism was not liberalism, but a national movement built on race and ethnicity, however morally warranted it might have been. Lueger, von Schönerer and Herzl were all reacting to the loss of a traditional sense of belonging that appealed to a reactionary need for identity. Listen to Skorsk. Each of these political artists Schönerer, Lueger and Herzl grasped a social psychological reality which the liberal could not see. Each expressed in politics a rebellion against reason and law which soon became more widespread. In their manner of secession from the liberal political tradition and in the form of the challenge they posed to its values, this triad of politicians adumbrated a concept of life and a mode of action which constituted part of the wider cultural revolution that ushered in the 20th century. 58. Men and women were not necessarily destined to be liberal. They could also be tribal, defining themselves in modern ideological terms by geography, group, ethnicity, and/or religion. And that has helped lead from the late 19th century onward, picking up steam as it has gone along, to the weakening of Western civilization, since all civilizations rest to a significant degree on the repression of tribal and other instincts, something we know from Freud 59 since to be civilized is to judge people as individuals, not as members of a race or ethnic group, and also to constantly repress your natural, momentary desires, otherwise you may run afoul of the law or be ejected from polite company. But civilization is now in flux. The ongoing decay of the West is manifested not only in racial tensions coupled with new barriers to free speech, but in the deterioration of dress codes, the erosion of grammar, the decline in sales of serious books and classical music, and so on, all of which have traditionally been signs of civilization. One might counter that what is happening is merely an evolution of styles, and that society is more democratic because of it, since things like correct grammar and classical music and serious books are only elite conventions that the masses and popular culture reject. That may well be true, but it is precisely such an evolution of styles, and also of media, politics, entertainment, and so on, that register cultural change, which, in turn, can lead to the very decline Spengler speaks of. The West has crested, in other words, and with it has crested the main invention of the West, the sanctity of the individual and individual thought, that is by definition opposed to the crowd. This has been made worse by extreme poverty and social dysfunction within Western societies themselves, condemning groups and the neighborhoods where they live to impoverishment as individuals within those groups. In short, elites are increasingly conformist and the masses, especially the underclass, are more ignorant, as schools and other public services decline. Of course, many intellectual and journalistic elites believe that Western civilization is giving way over time to a more humane and rules-based global civilization, in which case explosions of primitive behavior, whether mass shootings, war, other atrocities, or extremist politics may abate somewhat. But just as likely there will be a civilizational vacuum, with anarchy becoming more prevalent. For the mechanization, automation, and routinized bureaucratic procedure imposed by experts, and by science itself, are bound to absolutely enrage a fair number of us, leading to the very loss of repression against instinct that civilization is supposed to impose in the first place. The more constrained we are all forced to be in our behavior and our beliefs, in other words, the more that political extremists, including violent and crazy groups, will seek to overturn the prevailing order. Such extremists will clash with the populace existing under a strict hierarchy. As the philosophers Friedrich Nietzsche and José Ortega y Gasset warned us, science is conspiring with crowd psychology, wrought, in turn, by urban life, to produce a race of mass men in the cities. Mass men can act in a conformist way, even as they believe themselves to be individuals existing above the nation-state. The two things are not necessarily in contradiction. Mass men, who will both rule and compose the urban populace, are heavily credentialed experts within their narrow cubicles of bureaucratic and subject matter existence, ignorant of what lies outside, and therefore prone to membership in virtual mobs, which are bent on the latest fad, or assaulting in one form or another the next victim and his or her reputation. The very expansion of knowledge creates ever more intense and minute fields of specialization, which drives workers into little cubbyholes of experience, making everything beyond those cubbyholes, aside from immediate psychological and carnal needs, unreal and prone to manipulation by, for example, social media demagogues. Such phenomena will help define city life of the future, or increasingly, of the present, as both PhDs and internet influencers tell us what to think. This is how the most erudite and scientific minds can fall under the sway of a pop musician, sports figure, or politician. If a bit of nonsense is repeated enough times on a cable news channel, the most educated among us may start to believe it. Ortega writes in his classic, The Revolt of the Masses, that the direction of society has been taken over by a type of man oblivious to the principles of civilization. He is obviously interested in automobiles, anesthetics, and all manner of sundries. And these things confirm his profound lack of interest in civilization itself. In an introduction to Ortega's book, Saul Bellow observes, The mass man loves gags. He is a spoiled child, demanding amusement, given to tantrums. His only commandment is, thou shalt expect convenience. And as Ortega summarizes, mass men are concerned only with their well-being, while showing no concern for the causes and reasons for that well-being. Thus, they imagine that their role is limited to demanding these benefits peremptorily, as if they were natural rights. Owning the latest device is not a natural right, neither is getting delivery of your favorite new product in 24 hours, or constantly being entertained in general. These have become things we now expect, but are, in fact, results of a highly evolved and therefore ever more fragile civilization. This is how civilization eventually dies. It is just such a soporific reality that political extremists will revolt against. In their revolts and upheavals, and in the mass obsessions, political, financial, and sexual, that the mass man will take part in, made vivid by interactive technology, conflict between different parts of the earth will intensify, even as there is an overbearing sameness to the cities of the earth. Mass men are particularly prone to extreme political ideologies, warned the 20th century diplomat and foreign policy realist Robert Strauss-Huep, since ideologies are mass products in the true sense, and represent the final, deepest degradation of reason. 62 Crowds, mobs, social conformity, and ideology all flow together, helped by technology. Usually it occurs in cities but periodically in virtual cities created by social media, like the January 6th mob. Despite the metaverse, the range of human experience itself will become increasingly narrow, so that wisdom and good judgment will be even more difficult to come by. The work-from-home phenomenon could intensify some of this, as it separates the wealthier classes from a mask and glove-wearing servant class that brings parcels to their doors and attends to them at high-end restaurants. This is how pandemics isolate the economic and social classes. The tech industry evangelizes about stretching the boundaries of human experience. But in the future the opposite may turn out to be the case. For a somewhat oblique picture of what this might look like, consider the perfectly engineered cities of China, built on massive surveillance technology and artificial intelligence, in which AI will keep watch over every city street. In the Chinese vision, both frightening and sleep-inducing, traffic jams will be alleviated, missing children will be quickly found, ambulances will get to their destinations faster, jaywalkers will be shamed, and the government will know your thoughts by way of your internet searches. Because most people do not concern themselves with the world of ideas, and value safety and convenience above all, the Chinese city may actually represent the ultimate challenge to the less efficient and mob-prone urban West. 63. Not too bad, you might say about these Chinese cities. Most people, if not intellectuals, could easily live with such a vision. Indeed, dystopia may only be in the eyes of the beholder. Yet, as Camus writes in The Rebel, it is in man's nature to revolt. Man's solidarity is founded upon rebellion, and rebellion, in its turn, can only find its justification in this solidarity. That is the conundrum. Control will only get you so far. The more control there is, whether by diversionary spectacles and other amusements, or by all manner of drugs and medications, or by the tyranny of the crowd, or the tyranny of a dictator, the greater may be the eventual reaction against it. The tyranny of the crowd, as we have seen, may be the most insidious of all these tyrannies and, by leading to self-censorship, may be the hardest to rebel against. Still, Ortega's mass man, the ultimate tool of the crowd, may not constitute, according to the cliché, the soporific end of history. For there will always be revolt. And the revolt may come when things go wrong, when life is suddenly not convenient for the mass man. And things periodically do go very wrong. Keep in mind that the ancient Greeks feared chaos because they were too rational themselves to discount what lay on the other side of rationality. It is clear that intermittent chaos is a condition that will not dissipate as science and technology deliver more wonders to humanity. Chaos need not happen strictly on the geopolitical level, when the end of absolutist regimes leads not to stable democracy but to various levels of anarchy and new forms of disorder, as we've learned from the Arab Spring and the mayhem that gripped Russia following the fall of communism in the 1990s. Chaos can also grip postmodern technological societies, where revolt takes the form of primitive paroxysms, embracing lies or violence or both, in a reaction against soulless technocracy and the tyranny of crowds that demand perfect virtue. And because anarchy is a permanent condition of the species, which encompasses periodic eruptions of barbarism, ideological movements such as communism and fascism are never actually dead, but only in occultation. We must always beware of the year 1, 1917, and 1933. The late Polish-born Israeli historian Zev Sternhell defined fascism as, in part, a revolt against the life of the great cities, which was dominated by routine, with no room for heroism. Fascism, Sternhell went on, was a true counter-civilization emphasizing the rediscovery of instinct of our deepest psychological and physical urges. Fascism had a strong romantic appeal, wrote the German-born American historian Walter Lequier. Passion was to be a substitute for reason, readiness to fight a substitute for useless sophistic arguments. With fascism there was always this obsession with virility. 65 Fascism, in short, is the bully's ideology. It is the very soulless, effete, and postmodern urban civilization that has been growing up all around us that, it turns out, may provide fertile soil for fascism, by providing it with an environment it can rally against. Communism, too, or some variation of it, may find a sort of rebirth, only because it idealizes the romantic and seemingly virtuous left-wing extreme, and is thus suited to the 21st century crowd. My point is that the more conformist postmodern urban civilization forces us to become, the more often we will face revolts from the new old zealotry of the right and left. Remember that totalitarianism itself is rooted in a perversion of Western thought, according to the great Harvard thinkers of the 1950s Zbigniew Brzezinski and Carl Friedrich. For example, as they point out, the idea of progress, so peculiar a product of the Western mind, is embedded in the totalitarian thought so deeply that it would collapse if this idea were eliminated. Of course, when liberals and neoconservatives talk of progress, they mean something vastly different than when Nazis and communists do. But the concept is the same, believing in a linear forward direction to history, which, by definition, is not tragic. That is, it does not admit to the tendency of things to go wrong, does not admit to ironic outcomes, but always aims in the direction of utopia. So what of the West, at least as we revere it, obviously without the perversions of totalitarian ideologies? What about the survival of individual thought? The yearning to escape from the crowd? For that is what the West, in the healthiest sense, is ultimately about, and what throughout the centuries has given Western civilization its peculiar power and dynamism. The West wrested the individual from the group, gave him or her autonomy, and thus gave birth to freedom. The brilliant 19th century Russian intellectual Alexander Herzen, anticipating Spengler and writing in the wake of the failed 1848 democratic revolutions in Europe, delivered perhaps the most pessimistic of warnings. Modern Western thought will pass into history and be incorporated in it, will have its influence and its place, just as our body will pass into the composition of grass, of sheep, of cutlets, and of men. We do not like that kind of immortality, but what is to be done about it? 67. That is, the West will gradually pass away. Herzen then widens his canvas. After the breakup of Rome came Christianity, after Christianity, the belief in civilization, in humanity. Liberalism is the final religion, though its church is not of the other world but of this. And liberalism, the finest achievement of the West, Herzen implies, will end up as one of modern man's shattered idols. In this way, his vision is akin to T.S. Eliot's. 68. This is what we are up against again, the natural process of history that will undermine and dilute the West, and all it stands for. As globalization naturally plunges the West into the cross-currents of other civilizations, and extreme forms of identity politics trample the rights of the individual, historic liberalism now has the task of infinitely postponing Herzen's vision. Historic liberalism, exemplified by thinkers such as Edmund Burke, John Stuart Mill, and Isaiah Berlin as the champion of individual agency and of an open mind, offers the ultimate rebuke to the crowd. Historic liberalism has as its root the willingness to entertain reasonable ideas different from one's own. Liberalism is not too sure that it is right, said the great jurist Learned Hand. 6 Modern conservatives fit within this category, too, since they aim to conserve what is best in Western liberal thought, something that will be particularly challenging in an age of uncontrolled artificial intelligence. Liberalism thus delivers a critique to extremist ideologies like fascism and communism, and to the fate Herzen had in mind. Combating the folk and the mob, cultivating moderation in both foreign and domestic policy amid incipient global anarchy and roiling geopolitics caused by the decline of the great powers, is at root about being a liberal. This is certainly not new, but in the face of all the material I have presented, it is poignant. That said, even liberals must realize their philosophy's own limitations, and thus not be overly zealous. Because liberalism, on account of its focus on individual rights, taken to an extreme, can ultimately mean the erasure of borders and boundaries based in geography, history, and nature, writes Notre Dame political scientist Patrick Deneen. 7. Indeed, liberals must seek their ends in moderation, or else national cultures themselves are threatened by individual rights run amok. Liberalism must not hate all soil ties, I mean, or else incur the wrath of Spengler and his dark declinist vision. After all, a pure cosmopolitanism, by rejecting any closed geographical space where democracy has always flourished, can itself be anti-democratic. 71. That is why we must always remember 1848, the year of the failed democratic revolutions across Europe, when liberalism and nationalism actually fought on the same side of the barricades, writes Robert Strauss-Huep. 72. The failure of those revolutions was not preordained, however, but was a matter of many tenuous contingencies. Had the 1848 revolution succeeded, which they almost did, there might have been no World War I and following that no Hitler. History, once again, is a series of hinges. Even if the trends are bad, as I have certainly enumerated, better and worse outcomes are always available. Indeed, precisely because Spengler's historical perspective is so long and broad, urban civilization, as we know it, may yet find renewal and have more miles to run. Oxford University philosopher William McCaskill writes that we stand at the beginning of history. For every person alive today, 10 have lived and died in the past. But if human beings survive as long as the average mammal species, then for every person alive today, 1,000 people will live in the future. We are the ancients. On the scale of a typical human life, humanity today is barely an infant struggling to walk. 73. By that time frame, my relentlessly pessimistic argument is fleeting. Whole new cycles of history await that will overwhelm everything that I have just written. But that does not mean that what I have written does not matter. Humanity may go on for tens of thousands of years, or it may destroy itself in short order. And even if it goes on, it is unclear how free and unprogrammed by machines human beings will be. Can we reclaim the true freedom and diversity of Jane Jacobs's sidewalk? The direction of history is unknowable. There is no such tiling as automatic linear progress. Thus, we have no choice but to fight on, as the outcome is not given to any of us in advance. Weimar boasted many liberals and a true intellectual flowering. There was much hope in Weimar, but insufficient order. Avoiding Weimar's fate now constitutes the ultimate labor for the world. The end.